Last month, violent threats were made to the Hillel at Brown University, specifically against the director and the assistant director and their families. Ultimately, there were no weapons or bombs that were found on site, but I was struck by the particular gut punch of the threats to a Hillel, the center of Jewish life on campus in these times. What used to be a gathering place for some light Shabbat programming and an occasional guest speaker or a Talmud shiur has become, in many universities over the last 5 months, a refuge from the toxicity of campus, where the discourse has grown increasingly hostile and even violent toward Jewish students. Many Jews say that they study now in the Hillel buildings rather than in the libraries. And now many worry that even those sites are no longer safe for them. Meanwhile, my kid's university is facing multiple litigations alleging that it has repeatedly failed to create an environment that is safe for Jewish students. And just one recent piece of evidence knocked me off my feet. A Nazi-style poster posted around campus called "Who Rules the University? A Power Map." And you may not be surprised to see that at the top of that map, controlling it all, are not one but two nefarious forces. The AJC and other Zionist cultural orgs on one side, and Israeli occupation forces on the other. It's a stunner. And it turns out that it's not all in our heads. I spent time with a colleague in another city a couple of weeks ago, a brilliant rabbi and a justice leader. He told me that he called his city's multi-faith clergy team days after October 7th. This was a group that had stood together for a decade fighting all kinds of racism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. He said, "Hey friends, this moment is so fragile. Let's stand together and show people that even in this painful time, we can affirm each other's humanity." "No way," he was told by one faith leader that he had worked with for years. "I cannot be seen in public with a Jew." Many of us heard about Guernica, the literary magazine that just this past week published and then retracted an essay that was written by a left-wing Israeli Jew who wrote an article about the work that she had done in peacemaking before October 7th and how this moment had strained those relationships, which she desperately sought to rediscover so that she did not become untethered from her Palestinian partners. Amid protest, the piece was taken down with a note from the literary magazine: "We regret that we ever posted this. We have pulled it down from our site." Nevertheless, at least 10 staffers to this literary magazine resigned in protest that the piece had ever been posted in the first place. It was November when I was first deplatformed, not for my position on the war, not for my connection to Israel, not for any words that I had said or not said or any regrettable late-night rage posts on social media, but because, quote, "I just cannot platform a prominent Jew right now. I will lose half my listeners. I'm so sorry. I hope you understand." I haven't talked about it publicly, and it's been several months. And I wasn't planning on speaking about it publicly either until it happened again this past week. My short, sweet Passover offering for a prominent TV morning show, a couple of months in the making, was summarily cut. No matter that my message is about the plague of darkness and the biological and spiritual need for sacred accompaniment through our darkest hours. Quote, "It's just not the right time for a Jewish message. We'll get killed if you talk about Gaza, and we'll get killed if you don't talk about Gaza. So we'll just go with the cardinal giving an Easter message." Oh, and this is not deplatforming, I was told. It's just a programming decision, and it's a Christian country anyway. It doesn't make sense to do programming for the Jews, less than 3% of the population. We all have our own heartbreaking stories to share from the past several months, and at the same time, it feels like the public space that Jews live in is both increasingly narrow and increasingly hostile. And at the same time, it's getting harder and harder to talk about it. The word antisemitism, like so many words today, seems to have lost its meaning. And uttering that increasingly meaningless word seems to elicit rage and fury in some circles. Many argue that claims of antisemitism are exaggerated, that they're fueled by wealthy Jewish donors throwing their weight around. But isn't it a little bit antisemitic to suggest that pointing out antisemitism is only evidence of how much power Jews have? As Moshe Kasher writes, that's a gaslighting you never quite get used to. I am well aware that political forces are cynically using antisemitism today as a weapon to advance a political agenda that truly has nothing to do with keeping Jews safe, but is fueled instead by a desire to delegitimize labor unions, to delegitimize efforts to build a more just and inclusive America. This is a movement that endangers the Jewish community. This weaponizing of the fight against antisemitism also endangers our democracy. And we have to be careful as a community not to feed that beast. So we have to delicately navigate this conversation. We have to strive to be honest and clear-headed, not to be alarmist, even as we grow increasingly alarmed. When it came to building our community, we recognized that the driving force of the Jewish community for decades had been fortification against antisemitism. And we realized that we needed to cast a new mold. We would strive to organize not around fear, but around love. So it was 13 years into Ikar's existence, after literally hundreds of joyous, raucous Shabbatot and holidays, after years of learning and organizing and marching and serving, that I gave my first sermon on antisemitism after 13 years. The year was 2017. Rosh Hashanah that year was only a couple of months after Charlottesville, and I explained why it had taken me so long to talk about antisemitism. I said that day, it's not that it wasn't a problem before, it's just that there were always bigger, graver, more urgent problems for us to address. As Jews in America, facing moral crisis after moral crisis, plagued by racism and white supremacy, poverty, inequality, and climate denial, I did not want to draw focus primarily to our own victimization. Instead, I wanted to draw attention to the ways in which Jews were called to engage as a fairly privileged segment of a broader culture. I said that day that I still believed all of that to be true, but that we had to recognize that antisemitism is taking a dangerous new shape in America. That morning, and many of you were in the room, I addressed our relatively new understanding of antisemitism, which is, in Eric Ward's words, the beating heart, the fuel that moves the engine of white nationalism. I warned that antisemitism, described by James Carroll as the bug in the software of the West, was an insidious illness that excludes Jews from moral concern and allows for heinous acts of violence against us. It was and is clear to me now that the year 2017 was a moment of great significance in Jewish history. It marked the transition of America from a place like so many with an undercurrent of antisemitism to a place in which antisemitism was overt, unrepentant, and condoned by the state. I warned us that we must not shield ourselves from the reality of what was metastasizing before our eyes. At that time, years ago, it was very important to me to differentiate between right and left-wing antisemitism. I proclaimed again and again that antisemitism on the left hurt our hearts, but antisemitism on the right threatened our bodies. We need to differentiate between being unsafe and being uncomfortable, I said. But at some point in the ensuing years, It became clear to me that that approach was no longer sufficient. And in fact, it was Megillat Esther, the story that we read on Purim, that helped me realize this some 5 years ago. There's one part of that story of Purim that I bumped into that year. The way you accidentally walk into a wall one day that's always been in your home, but you realize you never really noticed it before. I walked into that wall of narrative 5 years ago, and it changed me. It awakened me, and I've thought about it ever since. So here's the context. Haman is full of rage toward Mordechai the Jew, whom he feels has disrespected him by refusing to degrade himself, bowing down to him. And Haman does what anti-Semites do, and actually what all racists do. He decides it would be insufficient to punish only Mordechai, who insulted him, but instead he would wipe out every last Jew in the kingdom. Haman is slighted by one Jew, but turns his animus toward all Jews. And he's so feverish in his determination to kill every last one of them that he approaches the king with an offer that the king cannot refuse. "I want permission to kill all of your Jews," Haman says. "They are different from the rest of us. It's no longer in our best interest to keep them alive here. And I want this so badly, king," he says, "so badly that I will pay you for the right to kill them. 10,000 talents of silver, a direct deposit into the royal treasury." Now that is a bold offer. 10,000 talents of silver, it turns out, was not nothing. According to some quick internet sleuthing that I did this week, that is roughly the equivalent of $226 million today. Or, I'm told, the monetary equivalent of 60 million days of labor. This payment, the rabbis suggest, was more than just an incentive for the king to agree. Haman recognized that the elimination of the Jews would mean a significant loss of revenue for the kingdom because dead Jews cannot pay taxes. So his donation was a kind of compensatory payment, a way of making the king and the treasury whole again. It's really quite thoughtful of Haman if you think about it, which makes the king's response even more astonishing. In the third chapter of the Megillah, we read, "Thereupon the king removed his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the foe of the Jews. And the king said, 'The money and the people are yours to do with as you see fit.' 'You have not only my permission,' says the king, 'you have my blessing.'" How can we make sense of this? Jews were hardly a hated minority under King Ahasuerus. In fact, they were fairly prosperous and well integrated into Persian society. There were Jewish judges and officials. Mordechai himself was an official in the king's court, thought by scholars to be a fully assimilated Jew on account of his name, which comes from Marduk, the Babylonian deity. We have no reason to suspect that the king harbors any ill will at all toward the Jews. If he does, we've never seen it before. And so the king's enthusiastic embrace of Haman's plan ought to give us pause. Thus comes the Talmud to explain. In Tractate Megillah, we read the story of two neighbors. One has a massive mound of dirt just taking up space in his backyard that he would love to get rid of. The other one has a trench, a giant hole in his yard, which he would love to fill. The two mull over their predicament for some time, until one day, for reasons that we don't fully understand, the owner of the ditch finally turns to his neighbor and pointedly asks, "Would you be willing to sell me some of your dirt so that I can fill my hole?" And the owner, who was anxious to rid himself of the excess dirt on his property, replies, "Tulo tabachinam, vahavalai. Are you kidding me, brother? I will give it to you for free." Similarly, the rabbis say, we are to understand that while it had not been obvious at the time, King Ahasuerus himself also harbored the fantasy of the Jews' disappearance, albeit a more subtle, latent fantasy than Haman's. Who, with a mound of dirt on their property, would not want it gone? And yet Achashverosh was reluctant to initiate the conversation. It was not until Haman revealed his own aspirations that he shared that he was willing to do the dirty work himself, literally take the dirt off of his hands, that King Achashverosh's subterranean fantasy emerged into the light of day. And that is why the king accepted no money from Haman. They were both doing the other a favor. In other words, Haman's hatred for Mordechai and the Jews was alone not sufficient to create the conditions for annihilation. It was only when his hatred met up with the quieter hatred in the heart of the king that the Jews' lives were truly in danger. Here the Megillah, which masquerades as a parody, as a spoof, as a silly story of feasts and fantasy, reveals an eternal truth about the way that anti-Semitism manifests in the world. The great danger is not one anti-Semitism or another. It's when the conditions of our society allow for a flourishing of anti-Semitism from multiple quarters at once. Ever since I encountered this text, I have refused to engage in that debate over which is worse, left or right. It's all worse. The fact of its ubiquitousness and its increasing normativity, that is the real danger. It's been a few years now, and sometimes I feel like I'm screaming into the wind. How can an anti-racism movement not interrogate its own anti-Semitism? How can people who dream of creating a liberated, multiracial, multi-faith democracy fail to understand that holding on to just this one itty-bitty racism will cause the whole house of cards to crumble? How can we make sense of a movement for justice succumbing to and even being brought to the brink by entrenched racism against Jews? Many of you read last month Dara Horn's synthesis of David Nirenberg's scholarship explaining this phenomenon. Throughout history, if piety was a society's ideal, then Jews became the embodiment of impious blasphemers. If secularism was the idea, then Jews were backward pietists. If capitalism was evil, then Jews were the bankers. If communism was evil, then Jews were the communists. If nationalism was glorified, then Jews were rootless cosmopolitans. If nationalism was vilified, then Jews were chauvinistic nationalists. Anti-Judaism thus becomes a righteous fight to promote justice. Anti-Semitism is a conspiracy theory. The big lie, she writes, that Jews are supervillains manipulating others. The righteous fight for justice, therefore, does not require protecting Jews as a vulnerable minority. Instead, it requires taking Jews down. This is a mind bender, right? And similarly, Franklin Foer wrote in his cover piece for The Atlantic last week that anti-Semitism is a deeply embedded mental habit, a tendency to fixate on the Jews, to place them at the center of the narrative, overstating their role in society and describing them as the root cause of any unwanted phenomena, a centrality that seems strange given that Jews constitute about 0.2% of the global population, or as the producer told me, less than 3% of America. This helps explain the flyer circulating around my kids' campus and the muted reaction to threats to violence against Jews around the country and around the world. Anti-Semitism today is not seen as an injustice like other forms of racism. In fact, it's a yearning for justice that makes good people turn on the Jews, or so they claim. Because the Jews are the center of the narrative. Because the Jews are the root cause of all human suffering. Because the Jews are a nefarious force, a fifth column, striving for world domination. And once you understand that analysis, it starts to make sense why people who claim that they care about human rights and human dignity, about women's rights and bodily autonomy, found themselves downplaying, denying, justifying, or even celebrating atrocities committed against Israeli Jews. It is chilling. In 1948, just as the world was grappling with the extent of the devastation of the Jews of Europe, Simon Rabinovitch wrote an essay called Am HaHolech VaMet, Israel, the Ever-Dying People, in which he famously makes the argument that if you look at Jewish history, you will discover that there has never been a generation of Jews that did not think that they were the last. Now, this is an unlikely argument to emerge in the immediate aftermath of the Shoah, the Holocaust, but I wonder if it lifted Jews' spirits to read that the pessimism that many of them felt at that moment was actually definitional to Jewish self-expression and, in fact, part of the Jewish psyche in every generation. Amid cover stories today warning that the golden age of American Jews is ending, we have to ask ourselves, is this just the latest iteration of eternal Jewish anxiety? Or is there something distinct about this moment, something that signals a true shift in Jewish consciousness and continuity? I worry that this moment really is different. And I say this today not to scare us. I say it because the hour demands more than quiet expressions of concern. We have to be honest about the danger that we are facing right now. When anti-Semitism flourishes, when overt meets latent anti-Semitism, we are not safe. We've seen too many statistics and stories of violent assaults on Jews, desecration of our sacred spaces, deplatforming of prominent Jewish voices, threats to our schools and synagogues and community centers, not to sound the alarm. And that is not all. We have to be clear that it is never only Jews who are endangered by anti-Semitism. The vision of collective liberation, the vision of a just and loving society, an anti-racist society, is fundamentally incompatible with anti-Semitism. When Jews are deplatformed, when our voices are erased from mainstream environments, when threats of violence or actual violence are received with no more than a tired shrug, that signals to us that our culture is steeped in anti-Semitism and that literally no one is safe. Because the anti-Semitic lie endangers not only Jews, it endangers our democracy. Please hear what I am saying today. The bulwark against authoritarianism has been a strong, multiracial, multi-faith coalition. That coalition is broken today, and it risks being fractured beyond repair. Once again in history, the Jews are being used as the wedge to drive apart the only movement that can save us from authoritarianism. We are standing in a very precarious moment, only months before what promises to be an extremely contentious election. Now, every prophetic reading that we read here on Shabbat morning, every Haftarah, ends with a nechemta. It has to, with some words of consolation. And every sermon ends with words of hope. It's irresponsible to sound the alarm and then send people off to lunch without that. But I don't want to be trite about this. So I'm going to tell you the only thing that I really know and trust in my heart. I am not optimistic about where we are in this moment in history. But I will forever remain hopeful, because hope is about imagination. Hope is about dreaming of a better future and then fighting to make that future a reality. And here's where I may differ from some of the current dominant voices on anti-Semitism. I do not believe that anti-Semitism is an inevitability or that it is an eternal force in the natural world. That same story from Megillat Esther that warns us of the danger of a culture of latent anti-Semitism meeting overt hatred also plants for us the seeds of hope. That story ends after too much violence, which we will talk about in the days ahead. That story ends with the Jews prevailing. And in the very last line of the Megillah, we read that Mordechai assumed a position of honor back in the king's court. So they must have found some way to reconcile. And he was highly regarded, listen to the language, by most of the people. Not by everyone, but by most of the people. The text says that he was a constant seeker of good for his people and an unwavering spokesperson for peace for his time and for all of his descendants. This story, the Purim story, has a happy ending. And our story can too. I pray that it will. Shabbat Shalom.
Hi, it's Rabbi Brous again. Thank you so much for listening. Want more content like this? I hope you'll subscribe. And please consider making a contribution to IKAR so we can continue to work toward the fulfillment of our mission to reanimate Jewish life, to embody moral courage, to nurture the spirit, and to work to decipher what it means to be a human being in the world today. Visit our website at IKAR.org. That's IKAR.org. And I hope to see you, maybe even in person, sometime soon.